Thanks everybody for coming. So today I'm going to talk to you about DNA methylation and cancer. So I'm a faculty member in the cancer genetics department, and DNA methylation is my main field of study. So to start off, I want to give you guys some vital statistics, some beginning statistics on what is in our genome and how that's packaged into the nucleus. So the human genome contains 3 billion base pairs of DNA. Now that's a lot of base pairs of DNA. That covers about 50,000 different genes. And one base pair of DNA is 0.34 nanometers long. So if you do the math real quick, what you come up with is about 2 meters of DNA if it were lined up in a straight line in the nucleus of every cell. So, put another way, each base pair typed side by side would fit 30 encyclopedia volumes. And two haploid genomes join at fertilization, but then the adult human body has 10 trillion nucleated cells. So that's a whole lot of times that the cell needs to replicate 3 billion base pairs of DNA and make sure that it's replicated properly. But not only that, it has to take that 2 meters of DNA and fit that properly into the nucleus. And it has to do that in a regulated way every time cells divide to get to those 10 trillion nucleated cells. So, you might think, well then, how can we possibly exist? This is an incredibly complex feat. Well, we have complex systems to faithfully replicate the genome. We have DNA repair enzymes that recognize error, put the brakes on cell division, put the brakes on S phase, and allow for the DNA to be repaired. So this DNA repair system proofreads and fixes errors or brakes before they can cause problems. But we also have a complex system of chromatin formation that protects, packages, and compartmentalizes the genome. And this contributes to patterns of gene expression. And this is why we're interested in studying this. So if you think about this, we've got about 50,000 genes. In any one cell type, roughly 10 to 15,000 genes are actually expressed. The difference between a liver cell and a cancer cell isn't in the genes, it's in the genes that are expressed. And a part of what regulates which genes are expressed or which genes are not expressed is exactly how that DNA is packaged. So the genes in a liver cell that should be on only in a kidney cell are going to be packaged differently than the genes that should be on in the liver cell. Those are going to be kind of put onto the back shelf, kept away from the transcriptional machinery. And epigenetic mechanisms, the way the DNA is packaged around histones and DNA methylation, contribute significantly to this packaging, the opening up the accessibility of a gene to transcriptional complexes or closing down accessibility of that gene. So, how do we exist? Well, if all of this stuff goes wrong, individual cells commit suicide if things get too messed up, or apoptosis, okay? And in cancer, we know the problems occur with each of these systems. So we're going to talk today about the packaging system, DNA methylation's role in that packaging system, and how that goes wrong in cancer. So I like this quote from Jerry Shea, and he said at an aging conference where he said, "The best way not to get mutations is to not divide. Unfortunately, one of the consequences of being a multicellular organism is that some of our tissues have to divide a lot." And what he's referring to here is this problem that I just laid out for you. You've got 3 billion base pairs of DNA that need to be replicated and packaged properly. It affords a lot of opportunity for mutations to occur. And so we know from greater than 65 years of research that genetic mutations are key drivers of cancers. There's aneuploidy, incorrect chromosome number, loss of heterozygosity, point mutations, translocations, all of these are known to contribute significantly to cancer. But just as importantly and more recently appreciated in the last 15 to 20 years are epigenetic mutations or epigenetic changes that can contribute to cancer. And these include hypomethylation of repetitive elements in the genome, which we're going to talk a bit about, hypermethylation of CpG islands we'll talk about, and I'll touch on histone changes, changes in histone methylation or histone acetylation and deacetylation. And it's become clear over the last 20 years that these types of changes contribute at least as much as these types of changes to cancer progression. So we know that cancer is a disease of the genome. There's genomic instability. And that leads to, ultimately, a phenotype through loss and gain of function, loss of tumor suppressor gene function, gain of oncogene function, contributing to the cancer phenotype. We also know that there are certain genes that help to regulate these pathways. And there are key mutations that are found in cancers. For example, mutations in BUB1 lead to inaccurate segregation of chromosomes during mitosis, leading to aneuploidy. And that can contribute to cancer. Mutations in a gene like MLH1, which is a DNA repair gene, recognizes mismatch mutations and point mutations. If the repair gene's broken, you can accumulate mutations throughout the genome. So this is an accelerator mutation, again, leading to loss and gain of function, ultimately to cancer. And we know from the observation that there are a lot of aberrant methylation changes in cancer. We don't fully know what regulates that yet. We know the enzymes that write the methylation. We know some proteins that read the methylation. We even know some enzymes now, which we didn't know 10 years ago, that erase the methylation. But we still don't know how that whole process is regulated to give us this aberrant methylation pattern, which then contributes to the cancer phenotype. So what is DNA methylation? In mammalian systems, when we're talking about DNA methylation, we're talking about this right here, the addition of a methyl group to the number 5 carbon of cytosine. So cytosine, or 5-methylcytosine. Now, this does not change the coding of the DNA, hence it's referred to as an epigenetic change. It's on top of genetics. That's what the epi stands for. And what that means is that if you have a codon encoding for an amino acid, and that codon contains a C, if it contained a methyl C, it would still encode for the same protein. Okay, so it's not a coding difference. But it does affect significantly how the DNA behaves and how it's packaged. Also, we've always known intuitively and observationally that you can reverse this reaction. You can have demethylation of 5-methylcytosine to cytosine, although it wasn't until recently that we understood the mechanism, the enzymatic mechanism behind how this works. So, some basic points about DNA methylation. It is critical to normal development, and it is tightly regulated. So we're going to talk about the 3-methyltransferase enzymes, DNMT1, DNMT3A, and DNMT3B. Each of those individually have been knocked out in mice, and it's been embryonic lethal for all of them. It's critical to regulating the way the genome changes as cells try to differentiate. The DNA methylation we're discussing occurs almost exclusively at CpG dinucleotides. So a little bit about this notation. This is cytosine 5' to guanine. This P indicates the phosphate backbone. This gives you an indication of direction. GPC is not a target for methylation. Only CpG is a target for methylation. Methylation process uses S-adenosylmethionine, or SAM, as the methyl donor molecule. So an enzyme takes the methyl group from this donor molecule, SAM, to put it onto the DNA. Now, the CpGs that are in repetitive elements, which account for about 90% of the CpGs in our genome, are highly methylated. This is the normal state. CpG islands, on the other hand, are generally unmethylated, and we're going to spend some time talking about what are CpG islands and why are they unmethylated. The exceptions to this rule about CpG islands being generally unmethylated in the normal state are the inactive X chromosome in females. Nearly all CpG islands on the inactive X chromosome are highly methylated. And imprinted genes. You may not know about imprinted genes, but I think your next lecture or one of your upcoming lectures will touch on imprinted genes. These are genes that show parent of origin specific expression patterns, and DNA methylation on one or the other alleles plays an important role in regulating imprinting. So, where are the methylation targets in the genome, the CpGs? Well, first of all, How many of them are there? So we're talking about dinucleotides here. So there are 16 possible dinucleotides. There's CC, there's CG, CT, CA, etc. 16 possibilities. So given that, CPGs just statistically should make up about 1/16 of the genome. But in fact, they don't. They only make up about 1/80 of the genome. So CPG over evolutionary time has become depleted from the genome. And that is because methyl C, so here's a methylated cytosine residue, is hypermutable. There can be a spontaneous deamination reaction that occurs that converts this methyl C into a T. Now, the cell recognizes this as a mismatch, and it's repaired by thymine DNA glycosylase, and you revert back to an unmethylated C and have no mutation. But a lot of times this doesn't happen. And we're talking about evolutionary time here, so there's a lot of opportunity for this to occur. And so over time, you get depletion in the genome of this CG converted to a TG, these transitions. So the hypermutability of 5-methylcytosine has played an important role in how the genome has evolved. And it also has been seen to play a role in cancers. An example is P53. 50% of the mutations in P53 involve these C to T transitions at CPG dinucleotides. So here's just looking at the structure. Cytosine, you have a DNA methyltransferase enzyme, uses S-adenosylmethionine as the methyl donor molecule to put the methyl group on the number 5 carbon. Now you have 5-methylcytosine. All it takes is a spontaneous deamination to convert that to thymine. So because of this deamination reaction, C to T transitions occur at 10 to 40-fold higher rate than other types of mutations. So that's a lot of extra burden of mutation that the cell needs to be able to recognize and repair, and it's not perfect at it. And so this has reduced the amount of CPG dinucleotides in the genome to about 5 times lower than would be predicted. Lower than that predicted 1/16. It doesn't make up 1/16, it makes up 1/80 of the genome. So now we know about the numbers of methyl targets in the genome, but where are they distributed? So 90% are found scattered throughout repetitive elements of the genome. They are mostly methylated. And this methylation plays an important role. It helps to reduce risk of deletion by recombination, and it reduces insertion mutation by limiting transposon activity, and it's important for centromere stability. I'm going to show you an example of a disease where this occurs, where a problem with the centromere stability occurs. Okay, so the methylation of these repetitive elements, the 90%, how important is this? Well, one thing we talked about was insertion mutation by limiting transposon activity. Here is a great example of how these repetitive elements need to be methylated for silencing. This is the agouti mouse, or the agouti locus in mouse. So in some strains of mouse, there's an intracisternal A particle, or a repetitive element that has a strong retroviral promoter on it that has inserted upstream of the endogenous agouti promoter. And in most cases, that IEP is methylated and everything is fine. The agouti locus is controlled by its normal endogenous promoter, and you get proper coat color and proper everything else in this mouse model, or in this mouse. However, if this IEP becomes unmethylated, and one way you can do that is by feeding pregnant female mice a low methyl donor diet, so there's low methyl going into the system, this can lead to demethylation of this IEP. The strong retroviral promoter element here takes over the endogenous promoter, and now you get expression off of this promoter, which is now unregulated and at very high levels, and this causes a constellation of phenotypes, including the change in coat color, the agouti, typical agouti mutation. So the lack of methylation allows the use of the IAP promoter, and that leads to high-level ubiquitous expression of the agouti gene. So this is just one example. This is one repetitive element to give you an idea of how important the DNA methylation is. So we talked about the 90% of CPGs. What about the other 10%? Those are found in CPG islands. Now, CPG islands are short stretches with almost the expected frequency of CPG, meaning nearly 1/16th of this stretch of DNA is CPG, which would be the expected frequency. So unlike the rest of the genome that's at least fivefold depleted for CPG, CPG islands have retained the CPG. Why? Well, the depletion of CPG from the genome is due to the hypermutability of methylcytosine. CPG islands are actually unmethylated, and so they don't suffer from this hypermutability. So over evolutionary time, they've been protected. But why should these areas be protected? Well, if evolution is protecting something, there's probably a reason for it. And these CPG islands tend to be found in the promoter regions of genes. So while it may be okay to mutate in a repetitive element, a methyl C to a TG, it's probably not okay to do so in regulatory regions of genes. So over time, these CPG islands have been protected from mutation because they've been protected from methylation. So in normal situations, they are mostly unmethylated. They're often found in the promoter regions of genes. And this is just what I said about why they've been protected over evolutionary time. And so if you do methylate a CPG island, what happens? Well, what it does is it shuts down transcription. So if you have a CPG island in the promoter region of a gene that's unmethylated, this gene can be actively transcribed. And this won't necessarily be actively transcribed. You need positive acting transcription factors to be present to turn the gene on. However, if this CPG island is hypermethylated in the promoter region, transcription is repressed. Even if all the positive transcription factors are present, the methylation here blocks their ability to bind and form a transcription initiation complex. And so CPG island hypermethylation in promoter regions of genes shuts down transcription. So what do we know about DNA methylation in cancer? There's been two broad observations been made a long time ago. We know that genome-wide, there's hypomethylation, loss of methylation, of normally methylated CPG dinucleotides throughout the genome. This is primarily in repetitive elements. And we know that tumor suppressor genes can be inactivated by CPG island hypermethylation, a gain of methylation in their promoters. And this CPG island hypermethylation is analogous to loss of function mutations by genetic means, such as deletion or point mutations. So transcription and acetylation and methylation are all interlinked. This lecture is mostly about DNA methylation, but I want to put a little bit of time to put this into a context of chromatin for you, which is the histones, and how the DNA wraps around the histone octamers and how those histone octamers can interact with each other and with DNA methylation. So broadly speaking, in transcriptionally incompetent heterochromatin, you have low level of histone acetylation and a high level of DNA methylation. And in transcriptionally competent euchromatin, you have a high level of histone acetylation and a low level of DNA methylation, and these are the areas where you can have active genes. These are areas of the genome that are silent. The association between transcription and histone acetylation is important. The histone amino tails stick out from the histone core where the DNA wraps around it. And if acetyl groups are highly negatively charged. So if you have histones, a series of histones next to each other, beads on a string type of figure, if you can imagine that, where all the histone tails are highly acetylated, that's a lot of negative charge. They're repelling each other, opening up the structure, opening up the chromatin, making that DNA accessible to transcription factors or transcriptional initiation complexes. So this is why active genes that are actively being transcribed have high levels of acetylated histones. Now, on the other hand, if you remove all those acetyl groups from the histones, now you've gotten rid of all that negative charge, you've neutralized things, that can allow for the nucleosomes to pack in close together to form a higher order structure, and that shuts down the chromatin making that DNA inaccessible to transcriptional initiation complexes and transcription factors. So there are some key components to understanding the relationship between DNA methylation and these histone modifications. First key component are methyl binding domain proteins. So there are these MBDs, methyl binding domain proteins 1, 2, 3, and 4, and MECP2. They bind only methylated CpG. They will not bind the unmethylated version of CpG. And when they do that, what they're doing is they're translating that biochemical signal of a methyl group on that CpG into a biological readout. And that biological readout is protein binding, and with it, it recruits protein complexes that have histone deacetylase activity and transcriptional repressive activity. So if you've got a CpG island that has a lot of methylated CpGs in that promoter, the way that gets shut down is by recruiting these methyl binding domain proteins, which recognize the methyl CpG. They bring with them protein complexes that deacetylate the histones, removing all of that negative charge, allowing that structure to collapse, and they also bring along transcriptional repressive activity. Now, you don't need to know all of these details, but just to give you a picture of what's going on, there are also histone methylases. SUVAR39 is one of them, and it methylates the number 9 lysine on histone H3 that's also associated with closed chromatin structures. And there's another protein, HP1, or heterochromatin binding protein 1, that provides a crucial link between histone methylation and DNA methylation by recognizing this H3K9 methyl state and recruiting DNA methyltransferases to help solidify that closed structure, kind of creating a circular loop, reinforcing loop. You don't need to know all of this detail. I'm just trying to give you a broad context to understand why we're talking about DNA methylation and how it's relating to transcriptional silencing. So here's an example, a schematic, where we have a transcribed region. DNA is in a permissive state where you've got unmethylated DNA, open chromatin structure, acetylated histones, opening that chromatin structure up, allowing for transcription factors and DNA or RNA polymerase to bind. However, if you are in a repressed region, you've got a lot of methyl cytosine, methyl binding domains recognizing that methyl cytosine, eliminating acetylation of those histones, allowing that structure to be more closed, and in addition, the methylation of H3K9 and the binding of heterochromatin binding protein 1, all contributing to this closed structure blocking access to the DNA. And this correlates here with showing high levels of DNA methylation versus low levels of DNA methylation, comparing euchromatin to heterochromatin. So my presentation is broken up into four sections, so I've got a couple of summary slides at each of the four sections. So this is the end of the first section. If I were going to be studying for an exam, I would definitely make sure I understand everything that's on those summary slides. So, summary one. We talked about how DNA methylation is one type of epigenetic modification of the DNA. It's tightly regulated and critical for normal development. It plays a role in imprinting, exon activation, centromeric stability, silencing of retroviral elements, and it reduces the potential for somatic recombination and insertional mutation by transposon activity. CpG islands, on the other hand, are generally unmethylated. They're often found in promoter regions, and this unmethylated state allows for expression. It keeps it in an open chromatin structure. The regulation of DNA methylation breaks down in cancer. In general, we find hypomethylation of repetitive elements and hypermethylation of CpG islands. One thing I want to emphasize about this, it's not all repetitive elements that become hypomethylated, and it's not all CpG islands that become hypermethylated. In fact, it's a minority of those where this happens, and understanding what regulates which CpG islands become hypermethylated is a very intensive field of research right now. Additional summary, DNA methylation is tightly linked with histone modifications. It induces and is induced by H3K9 methylation. It induces histone deacetylation through the binding of methyl binding domain proteins. And DNA methylation contributes to setting up euchromatin and heterochromatin regions. Euchromatin lack DNA methylation. They have acetylated histones, and this is permissive to gene expression. Whereas in heterochromatin, there's a high degree of DNA methylation, deacetylated and methylated histones, and this is restrictive to gene expression. So now we're going to spend a little bit of time getting into the nitty-gritty of some of the enzymes that do this work. So this is a structure of DNA, and this is a crystal structure of an E. coli methyltransferase, MHHA1. And this is the crystal structure of the mammalian DNA methyltransferase 2. First of all, you can see there's a lot of similarity. So these methylation has been conserved all the way back to bacteria. And the one thing I want to point out here is that, let's see. Okay, so here's where we're putting the methyl group in the DNA. And here, these enzymes have this unique base flipping ability. The enzyme actually takes the cytosine out of the CG base pair, out of the helix, and flips it out where the activity can take place. Here is the S-adenosylmethionine, the methyl donor group, where the methyl is going to be placed onto the cytosine and then put back in as a base pair. You don't need to know any of this. So this enzyme, this idea of methylating the genome has been around and conserved ever since bacteria. There are a family of methyltransferases. I mentioned already DNMT1, 3A, and 3B. They all share this conserved C-terminal part, which is the catalytic domain. And this is where there's strong homology to the MHHA1 methyltransferase, the bacterial methyltransferase. So this is the business end of the enzyme, the catalytic. The N-terminal parts are more regulatory. They interact with other proteins and presumably help regulate where DNA methylation is going to be occurring. And we'll talk about a little bit of this. DNMT2 is just the catalytic domain. And DNMT3L has pieces of the catalytic domain, but not fully functional. So the N-terminal portions are regulatory. They have protein-protein interactions, and they can be important for DNA binding. We're going to talk about a few of these enzymes and some of the domains that are present. So DNMT1, this is the maintenance methyltransferase. This is the enzyme that's responsible for maintaining the methylation pattern in the genome, and I'll show you how it does that. But there are a few key regions to look at. So first, C-terminal catalytic domain. So this is the perfect catalytic domain. It retains all of these key motifs. There's the PCNA binding and DNA replication fork targeting sequences that are important for targeting DNMT1 to the replication fork, where it actually does its job, and for increasing the processivity, which is the ability to stay loaded on a single molecule for a long stretch of time to do its job. And I'm going to show you how that works, but this is what allows the DNA methyltransferase to be targeted during replication to that replication fork to copy the methylation pattern over from the parent strand or the template strand to the nascent strand of DNA. There's a zinc finger, which is important for binding DNA. There's this PB region, which is important for protein-protein interactions. That's important for chromatin binding to histones. And then there's this region that binds DMAP1, which is a transcriptional repressor. Oh, and we're going to talk later about this form. There's different isoforms of DNMT1. The major isoform is present pretty much everywhere at all developmental stages. I don't know anything about this DNMT1B isoform, but this DNMT1O isoform is interesting. We'll talk a little bit about it. It's found in, this is the oocyte-specific form, and it's missing. It's got a different amino terminus. So DNMT1's major function is maintaining the methylation. So you've got DNA that is methylated on both strands. So you've got CPG and then an opposite orientation on the other strand, GPC, well, CPG actually, but both Cs on each strand are methylated. When a replication fork comes through, the DNA polymerase puts in unmethylated cytosines into that position. And it's the job of DNMT1 to recognize this so-called hemimethylated state, where one strand's methylated but the other isn't, and then move along behind the replication fork and copy over the pattern of methylation from the parent strand or the template strand to the nascent strand, because otherwise the nascent strand would be completely unmethylated. All right? So to support this ability, the DNMT1 has a strong preference for hemimethylated DNA. In other words, it binds better to hemimethylated DNA than it does to naked DNA or to DNA that's methylated on both strands. It methylates the nascent strand at positions where the template strand is methylated, and it's highly processive. This is partly to do with its binding to PCNA. It increases its processivity. That means that once it loads onto the molecule, it can keep traveling along the molecule doing its job for a long period of time. It does, however, have a high affinity for cruciform structures, at least in vitro, and it can de novo methylate. So when we start to think about how do we get aberrant patterns of DNA methylation, this is something to keep in mind. While its normal job is maintaining methylation, it does have the potential to be taken out of context and to get up to some, I don't know, mischief, I suppose. Now, DNMT1, if you remember that picture, had the longest amino terminus of any of the DNMT1-methyltransferases. And that gives it a lot of opportunity to interact with other proteins, and in fact, it does interact with lots of other proteins. So here's some. PCNA, we talked about already, so that's important because it brings it to the replication fork and it increases the processivity of the enzyme. It binds to cell cycle regulators, P21, RB, E2F1. It binds to histone modifiers, histone-methyltransferases, histone deacetylases. It can interact with methyl binding domain proteins and heterochromatin binding protein, HP1. It can also interact with DNMT3A and 3B, which are the de novo methyltransferases we'll talk about next. Now, my point isn't that you memorize all of these interacting partners. The point is to say that there's a lot of co-regulation that goes on with this enzyme, DNMT1. And it's really, you know, just because something interacts in a biochemical assay doesn't necessarily mean that it has a biological function, so it's a little bit unclear exactly what is the full biological function of these interactions. Did they just happen to be in the same place at the same time, or are they actually functionally interacting with each other? So that's an open question. But one thing to consider is that the enzyme may have different partners in different settings. So an S phase is one setting, or a G0 cell is another setting. This may be the difference between its maintenance role, which is its major role, maintaining the methylation pattern, versus a potential de novo methylation role or a transcriptional repression role in G0, which again are potential roles. So DNMT3A and 3B, the do-over enzymes, these are the de novo methyltransferases. So if DNMT1 is going to copy over and maintain the methylation pattern, what lays down that pattern in the first place? That's where DNMT3A and 3B come in. So here's DNMT3A. First of all, it has that same catalytic domain that's functional, so it can methylate DNA. It has a strongly basic region, this PWWP domain, that helps with DNA binding and may target it to chromatin. It has this PHD domain, which is a zinc finger domain commonly associated with transcriptional repressors, and also helps to bind to chromatin. So the key differences between DNMT3 and 3B from DNMT1. First, these two enzymes have no preference for hemimethylated DNA. Okay, so DNMT1's job is to copy over methylation from one strand to the next. And so it has a preference for that status, that hemimethylated status. 3 and 3B are de novo methyltransferases. They don't have any such preference. They can bind naked DNA just as well. They have a de novo methylation ability, so they can take naked DNA and actually methylate it. An example of this was shown in Drosophila, which doesn't have DNA methylation, doesn't have any DNA methyltransferases. They took, I think it was either mouse or human, it was mammalian DNMT3A, put it into Drosophila cells, and found that the Drosophila DNA became methylated. Now, DNMT1 can be stimulated into de novo activity by methyl CpGs in cis and interaction with DNMT3A or 3B. So what that means is, in a non-replicating cell, DNMT1 might contribute to methylation spreading by recognizing DNA methylation CpGs in cis, meaning nearby CpGs, through an interaction with DNMT3A and 3B. So this can account for methylation spreading. And there's expression differences between 3A and 3B and DNMT1. DNMT1 is expressed in nearly all cells at all time points, whereas 3A and 3B are expressed at high levels in early embryogenesis and gametogenesis. They're expressed at low levels in the adult cells, and in the next section we're going to get into that in more detail and you'll see exactly why that is. And so we've got this idea of a methylation cycle that's really important. Somewhere along the way, you have unmethylated DNA. That can be due to active demethylation, enzymatic removal of methyl groups, or passive demethylation, a lack of maintenance. We'll talk a little bit about that. Then you have DNMT3A and 3B that lay down the initial methylation pattern, the de novo methylation, and once that is in place, then through replication and the action of DNMT1, you maintain the methylation patterns. So, form dictates function. There are small differences in the catalytic sites between 3A and 3B. So why are there two different enzymes for de novo methylation? It's one job, right? Just lay down the pattern. Why do we have two different enzymes? Some of these differences affect the enzymology. So DNMT3A is a distributive enzyme, whereas DNMT3B is a processive enzyme and has higher intrinsic activity. So what does that mean? A distributive enzyme, like DNMT3A, loads onto the molecule and doesn't really travel along. It just methylates where it lands and then falls off because it's not processive, it's distributive. And what's its function? Well, DNMT3A methylates single copy genes. It targets small regions. So that fits with the distributive function of the enzyme. DNMT3B, on the other hand, is a highly processive enzyme. So it loads in one spot, and it can travel along a large stretch of DNA. So what's found is that DNMT3B methylates pericentromeric regions, which are long stretches of DNA with high CpG content. So it's not only the processive ability of 3B that contributes to this, but it's also its higher intrinsic activity because it's got a lot more work to do. So that's a clear difference between the functions of DNMT3A and 3B. So, I mentioned before centromeric stability and one of the importances of DNA methylation. So, there's a disease called ICF syndrome, immunodeficiency, centromere instability, and facial anomalies. And it was found maybe 10 years ago to be due to a point mutation in DNMT3B. Normally, DNMT3B would methylate these pericentromeric regions. So these are highly repetitive regions with a high CpG content. They're normally highly methylated, and that's important to centromere stability. When they become hypomethylated because of mutations in 3B, you can see that they expand, and then they become unstable, and they create these radial chromosomes involving chromosomes 1, 9, and 16. So just a single mutation in one of these enzymes can cause this complex disease, ICF syndrome, all due to chromosomal instability at the pericentromeric regions. Okay, so back to 3A. There's a couple of isoforms. The major isoform in adult tissues is the long form. It's targeted to heterochromatin. DNMT3A2 is the short form. This is missing the amino terminus. This is the major form during embryogenesis, and it's targeted to euchromatin. This fits with its known role in focused methylation of single-copy genes. DNMT3B, there's a whole bunch of different isoforms. 3B and 3B2 are enzymatically active. They contain the full catalytic domain. You can see the others are missing pieces of the catalytic domain for 3B3, 4, and 5, but they are still targeted to pericentromeric regions and are thought to have a regulatory role. And little is known about 3B6, which just has this small 20 amino acid deletion. So point here is just simply that there are a number of different isoforms of both 3B and 3A. Yeah. Now, DNMT3L is a different gene. And I refer to this one as mother's little helper. This 3L lacks a PWWP domain. So this is the domain that helps target the 3A and 3B to the chromatin and for DNA binding. It lacks that, so it doesn't get to where it's supposed to go. It retains the PhD domain. It's associated with transcriptional repressors. That's this domain here. It lacks enzymatic activity because the conserved motifs have inactivating point mutations in them. So even though there's key motifs that are important for the catalytic domains of DNMTs, they have point mutations in them, so it doesn't have any activity. However, it interacts with DNMT3A, and it stimulates the relatively low enzymatic activity of 3A, and it's required for maternal imprinting. You're going to learn more about imprinting next lecture, but maternal imprinting means this would be loci who's expressed specifically from the maternal allele and not the paternal allele. Or maybe it's the other way around. I actually confused the two. But the point is that the 3A's contribution to a maternal imprinting is dependent upon DNMT3L. So even though it has no enzymatic activity itself, and it doesn't even bind DNA by itself, it can interact with the other enzyme, 3A, and has a very important function. DNMT2 is the ugly stepchild of the family. Even though it's pure catalytic domain, it doesn't have any of the regulatory domains, it actually doesn't methylate DNA. There's evidence that, in fact, it's a RNA methyltransferase. And we're not going to talk about RNA methylation at all. In fact, I don't even know anything about RNA methylation, except that it happens. And DNMT2 is ubiquitously expressed. It has no in vivo activity. Some low-level in vitro activity has been found, but it's also recently been found to be an RNA methyltransferase. So to summarize this second section, DNMT1 is the major DNA methyltransferase in adult somatic cells. Some important features about DNMT1 are that it has high affinity for hemimethylated DNA, which fits with its role as a maintenance methyltransferase. It's found at the replication fork. It's highly processive, binding PCNA to both help target it to the replication fork and to increase its processivity. It can de novo methylate in certain scenarios, and it binds many proteins that are involved in gene regulation and chromatin formation. DNMT3A and 3B, on the other hand, are the major de novo methyltransferases. They have no special affinity for hemimethylated DNA. They have high expression in early embryo and germ cells. 3A is distributive and used for focal methylation in single copy genes, whereas 3B is processive with higher activity, and it's important for methylation of repeats in the pericentromeric regions. An example is that mutations in 3B cause ICF syndrome, which results in expanded chromatin structure near the centromeres due to a lack of methylation. DNMT3L has no enzymatic activity. It has non-consensus catalytic regions. However, it binds to DNMT3A and to 3B, and it increases the enzymatic activity of DNMT3A. Interaction with DNMT3A is required for maternal imprinting. DNMT2 has no enzymatic activity demonstrated in vivo. It appears to have a functional catalytic region and no regulatory regions. Perhaps there are some other protein interactions we haven't discovered yet that could lead to its DNA methylation activity, but it seems to be an RNA methyltransferase and not really important for our discussions today. Okay, so I'm going to go back to this methylation cycle. How does this whole process get started? And how is it perpetuated? Okay, so we talked already before about this figure. And the demethylation aspects are very important during early embryogenesis and gametogenesis. And then, from that stripped down form of DNA, we need to establish the adult pattern, which is then going to be maintained. So, how do we demethylate the DNA? Right? So there's two ways to get to this unmethylated state, active demethylation and passive demethylation. Passive demethylation is replicating the genome without maintaining methylation on the nascent strand. So if you've got double-stranded DNA, both strands are methylated. If a replication fork goes through, the template strand's methylated, the nascent strand's unmethylated. Now normally, DNMT1 would maintain that pattern by copying it over. But if you keep DNMT1 away from the replication fork, now you've got hemimethylated DNA. If that goes through another S phase, another replication fork comes through, now you get a daughter cell that's completely demethylated. So this occurs in the female pronucleus and the early embryo up to implantation, and it's accomplished by DNMT1 being locked away in the cytoplasm, which is then later released into the nucleus. So I'm going to show you some evidence of this, but in the early rounds of replication of the female genome, the DNMT1 is kept away from the replication forks to allow for this passive demethylation to occur. Now, active demethylation is a quick enzymatic removal of methyl groups without DNA replication. So this doesn't require any replication. It's simply an enzymatic removal of that methyl group. The exact mechanism is unclear, although it's becoming more clear every year as we learn more about this class of enzymes I'm going to get to in a few slides. This definitely occurs in the male pronucleus. So there's strong evidence that this occurs in the male pronucleus. And it, in somatic cells, at some other time points, it may occur during differentiation from stem cells into different lineages. But we're going to focus on the male pronucleus, early embryogenesis, and gametogenesis. So DNMT1 has a different isoform that's specific to oocytes, this DNMT1O isoform, which is missing this amino terminus. And so I'm going to show a little bit of data from this study where they use two different enzymes, an enzyme that recognizes the full-length form, two different antibodies, an antibody that recognizes the full-length form of DNMT1, and another one that would recognize both the full-length and the oocyte-specific form. So first what they did is they looked by RT-PCR, designing primers to this differential region, and they found that DNMT1, as expected, is expressed in all cell types. But when they designed primers specific to this oocyte-specific form, they found it only present in the ovary. So then they did some immunohistochemistry, immunofluorescence. And here, up top, what we're looking at is staining of full-length DNMT1. And this is the oocyte. These bright staining cells are the somatic granulosa cells. So you can see there's plenty of DNMT1 in these cells, but in the oocyte, there's very little or no full-length DNMT1. And this is true up until the morula stage, where you start to see more DNMT1 staining, and then in the blastocyst stage. However, when they use the antibody that would recognize the oocyte-specific form, you can see that there's plenty of DNMT1O in this oocyte. So no full length, but plenty of the oocyte-specific form. And as these cells start to go into, as the oocyte becomes fertilized and goes on to the 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell stage, you can see that DNMT1O is excluded from the nucleus, and it's held into the cytoplasm in this periphery up until the morula stage. And this is due to DNMT1 binding a cytoskeletal annexin 5. So this is what I was telling you before about DNA methyltransferase 1 being excluded from the nucleus in early embryogenesis and being held in the cytoplasm. And it's through this binding to cytoskeletal annexin 5. And so if we look at what's the DNA methylation level over development, what we see is that in the germ cells, during primordial germ cell development, all the DNA methylation is erased. Nearly all, a little bit remains, but it's nearly all erased and is then reset to the adult form. But then, upon fertilization, in blue, we're looking at, let's see, in blue, we're looking at the male half of the genome. So upon fertilization, you get the male pronucleus and the female pronucleus. The male pronucleus goes through active demethylation within hours of fertilization. This does not happen to the female pronucleus. However, upon subsequent cell divisions, with DNMT1O being excluded from the nucleus and kept in the cytoplasm, the female pronucleus also goes through passive demethylation until about the Morula stage, where DNMT1 is released back into the nucleus. DNMT3A and 3B are also present to lay down the de novo pattern, and you start to accumulate DNA methylation patterns, again, which are then going to be maintained in the adult until they become a germ cell, and we go through the process again. So the red line is the female DNA, the blue line is the male DNA. This black line are the imprinted genes. So you can see that the imprinted genes during germ cell development go through this erasure and then setting of the adult pattern. But once fertilization occurs, they don't get demethylated by either approach, active or passive. This erasure during germ cell development is critical because you need to, if it's sperm development, you need to erase the maternal imprints in order to have the male methylation pattern or the male imprints. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some data that gives some evidence of this. So here, the immunofluorescence, we're looking in red at the methylated DNA, and in green, we're looking at the total DNA, and this is actually the merged. So here is the female pronucleus, here's the male pronucleus at 4 hours post-fertilization. And you can already see that this is more green, meaning there's less red signal. So there's already hypomethylation of the male pronucleus, 4 hours post-fertilization. At 6 hours, this is even more apparent. You can't even see the male pronucleus with the 5-methylcytosine stain, and this is true all the way through to 10 hours post-fertilization. So you can clearly see the difference here, where the female pronucleus retains this yellow, which meaning it's got both red and green signal. So you get this yellow. So it retains methylation throughout this time course, whereas you see rapid loss of methylation of the male genome. This can be observed then at syngamy, so where the two genomes finally align and merge. Here we're looking at total DNA. Here we're looking at 5-methylcytosine. And you can see this is the female chromosomes. Here are the male chromosomes, which aren't showing any signal. So you can see in the merged picture that the male chromosomes are all green with no red signal. So again, male and female genomes align in syngamy, and you can see this difference in the methylation pattern. So you get this rapid, even before the first cell division, this rapid active demethylation of the male pronucleus, but this doesn't occur in the female pronucleus. Then after that first cell division, again, we're looking at 5-methylcytosine in red, and total DNA in green in this merged field, you get progressive loss of methylation of the female genome. You can see less yellow, more just green showing up here, less red signal coming up in here, until you get to the blastocyst stage where you start to gain methylation. So these are some of the findings that, some of the evidence that showed this passive demethylation of the female half of the genome, active early demethylation of the male half of the genome. So why exactly does this occur differently in the two genomes? Well, it's not 100% clear, but there one hint may be in the fact that the oocyte DNA and the sperm DNA are packaged differently. So the sperm genome has a unique chromatin structure. It's a protamine-based packaging system instead of histones. So this is what we're used to seeing, DNA wrapped around a nucleosome, and this is true in the oocyte. However, in the sperm, because the sperm head that contains all that DNA is so tiny, it's a much tighter packaging system, where there's simply protamines in here, and so you get a very different system where upon 1 hour post-fertilization, both genomes have to unwind, and the sperm genome now needs to replace these protamines with histones. And it's at this time point where it's acquiring these new acetylated histones that the male genome is being demethylated. So the male genome is going through this decondensation process and then repackaging process at the same time that all of this DNA demethylation is occurring, which the female genome is not going through. So the thought there, this hasn't been proven yet, but the thoughts are that this is where there's a relationship between this unpackaging and repackaging process that's critical to the active demethylation that occurs in the male genome. And that's why it's different in the female pronucleus. So a few years ago, the TET enzymes were identified and their function understood, the 10-11 translocation proteins. So these are a family of proteins that are 2-oxalglutarate and iron-dependent dioxygenases, which all have the capacity to convert 5-methylcytosine to 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, and further to 5-formylcytosine and 5-carboxylcytosine. So basically what this is that the active demethylation, the enzymatic removal of the methyl group, isn't as simple as just simply cutting off the methyl group. In fact, for a long time, there was a huge argument in the field whether there ever could be active demethylation because it's such an energetically unfavorable thing to do to try to remove that methyl group. What people didn't realize is that's not actually what happens. What happens is that these enzymes promote the oxidation of the methyl group. So first, it becomes 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, adding this hydroxy group onto the methyl group. And then these enzymes can lead to iterative steps of oxidation, further oxidation to the formyl or the carboxyl form, which ultimately is recognized as a damaged DNA. And a DNA repair enzyme comes in, thymidine DNA glycosylase, for example, which then goes through base excision repair, cuts out this damaged base, and then DNA polymerase comes in and puts in an unmethylated cytosine, and then ligase comes in and closes the break. So what these 10 enzymes do is they basically induce the oxidation of the methyl group, ultimately leading to DNA damage, which DNA repair enzymes recognize and then fix by replacing the damaged base with an unmethylated cytosine. So that's how active demethylation occurs. And so it's been proven that the TET proteins can't actually do this step. You need a glycosylase to be involved or a base excision repair enzyme to be involved. And it's been proven that depletion of this base excision repair enzyme leads to accumulation of this very damaged form in mouse embryonic stem cells. And so there's been a growing interest in the field in understanding how this process is regulated. So this is a summary of the processes that we've talked about, how we have passive demethylation during the early embryogenesis. And I'm not going to go through all of this, but you have active demethylation of the male pronucleus early on, where you have protamine release and repackaging of the genome, and then passive demethylation during the early cell divisions. And then later, as the cells go into the blastocyst stage, you regain de novo methylation and maintain that methylation. So to summarize this section, both primordial germ cells and early embryos erased most methylation, and this helps to reset the DNA methylation pattern. Now, I said not all of the DNA methylation pattern is completely removed. The centromeric regions and imprinted sequences are excluded from this in early embryogenesis. We have passive and active demethylation of the female and male genomes after fertilization. Active demethylation occurs of the male genome. This is likely associated with replacing a protamine-based DNA packaging with histone-based, and it involves the oxidation of 5-methyl-C to 5-hydroxymethyl-C by the activity of the TET enzymes. Passive demethylation occurs in the female genome, and this is due to exclusion of DNMT1 and DNMT1O from the nucleus. And so therefore, you get replication occurring without maintenance of the methylation pattern. Yeah?
How does it avoid activating genes?
When you demethylate it, how does it avoid activating? Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know the answer to that. Certainly, it's been shown, for example, if you want to find, you've got a gene that you want to study and you don't know what to use as a positive control for expression of that gene, testis is one of your best places to look, because just about everything is expressed, even though it's at low level. Speaking to this idea of the different chromatin structure is allowing for more expression, but it's probably all at low-level expression. I think most likely in this early embryonic state, there's very low-level drive for transcription. You don't have any of the lineage-specific transcription factors on, for example. So it's only the transcription factors that are being brought over from the oocyte. So probably that limits the potential, but you have a good point. Okay. Methylation resets at implantation. You get de novo methylation by DNMT3A and 3B. And then this is maintained by the release of stores of DNMT1O into the nucleus, and the subsequent new production of DNMT1. Okay, so in this last section, I'm going to spend some time talking about how do we study DNA methylation. So we've gotten a bit away from cancer. We're going to go back into cancer now, now that we understand what is DNA methylation, what are the basic processes. So how do we study this in cancer? So to remind you of the primary observations about DNA methylation in cancer, first, there's a global hypomethylation. So that is demethylation of the repetitive elements. We don't really know if that's due to passive or active processes. We just know that it occurs. This increases chromosomal instability. It increases somatic recombination, which can contribute to loss of heterozygosity. It can lead to ectopic expression of genes. One example is by genes that are driven by parasitic DNA promoters like the IAP driving the agouti locus example that I showed you earlier. And in some rare cases, you can have demethylation of a CpG island promoter at an imprinted gene, for example. And then the other observation is that we get localized hypermethylation. Normally unmethylated CpG islands become hypermethylated. So there's roughly 29,000 CpG islands in the human genome. They're generally found in promoter regions, and when methylated, it's associated with gene silencing. And this has been observed for the silencing of tumor suppressor genes like P16 or GSTP1. So, how do we detect methylation of a gene? There are three basic strategies. We can use methylation-sensitive restriction enzymes, we can use bisulfite treatment, and we can use immunoprecipitation or affinity. I'm going to talk about all of these. So, some restriction enzymes will not cut if the DNA is methylated. An example is HEPA2. HEPA2 cuts CCGG, but will not cut C-methylcytosine GG. The isoschistomer, MSP, cuts the same site regardless of the methylation. So you can demonstrate by digestion with MSP1 that there is a CCGG site, and then you can demonstrate that it's methylated by showing that HEPA 2 won't cut it. And I'll give you an example of how that works on a southern blot. The second way, and this is the most commonly used way currently, well, this is pretty commonly used too, but one of the major ways it's used all the time now is by sulfite treatment. This chemically converts cytosine to uracil. 5-methylcytosine, however, is protected from this conversion. So this then creates a unique, this creates a sequence difference between methylated and unmethylated DNA. Methylated DNA, after bisulfite treatment, will retain those C's that were methylated. The unmethylated version of the same DNA would have those C's converted to uracil, and then after PCR and sequencing, those would read out as T's. So you would have T's in place of C's. And I'll show examples of that. And the other way is immunoprecipitation or affinity chromatography. So there are antibodies to 5-methyl-C, and there's also columns that you can make that contain the methyl binding domain proteins. So you can use these to enrich for the methylated fraction of the genome, same way you would do an immunoprecipitation for a protein. You can immunoprecipitate methylated DNA or affinity bind methylated DNA. So you can purify the methylated fraction and then look at what was enriched through various methods. And I'll show a couple of methods of that. And then conceptually, what do you want to know about DNA methylation? So you can use scanning approaches, or you can use candidate gene approach. So a candidate gene approach would be to ask if a specific gene of interest is methylated. Okay, so an example would be P16 in pancreatic cancer. So in pancreatic cancer, often one allele is deleted and one allele is present. However, there's no expression. And you want to ask, well, why is there no expression? Could it be that the other allele is methylated? So you could address that question using this candidate gene approach, looking for methylation of the remaining allele of P16 to see if that could be the cause of the lack of expression. A scanning approach asks a different question. What are the loci that are affected by CpG island methylation? So you've got an entire genome, 29,000 CpG islands. How many of them are hypermethylated in this cancer? How many of them are hypermethylated in that cancer? Which ones, or the question of how many, how severe is the aberrant hypermethylation phenotype? Is there more CpG island hypermethylation in metastatic cancer versus primary cancer? In triple negative breast cancer versus luminal A? This, with the scanning approach, you can study hundreds or thousands of loci in an unbiased way. The candidate approach often provides detailed information for a single locus. It can be applied to many samples, and it's highly sensitive. So if you want to know how frequently is P16 methylated in pancreatic cancer, if you have access to the samples, you can easily ask that question in thousands of samples with relatively low cost and with very high sensitivity. A scanning approach, on the other hand, provides less detailed information, but for many, many loci, the cost and complexity limit the number of samples, you have a lower sensitivity. So if you want to know what are all the methylated sites in pancreatic cancer, that's much more expensive, you have lower sensitivity, and so you can end up looking at less samples. Yeah, so if you're talking about CpG islands and promoters, almost exclusively unmethylated. That's the wild type scenario. So detecting hypermethylation is easy, right, because you're comparing to a low background. Now, when you look at a CpG island, let's say in a stretch of 100 base pairs, maybe there's 20 CpGs. You may find that in normal, that one or two of those CpGs show some level of methylation in normal. And that may vary exactly which CpG or exactly to what degree from person to person. But the overall context of that CpG will be unmethylated, invariably. If you look in the cancers, though, where you see aberrant methylation, what you'll see is like 18 out of those 20 will be highly methylated. So the difference can be tends to be very clear. When you get outside the context of CpG islands, however, this becomes much more complicated. So low level low-density CpG, perhaps in an enhancer region or a transcription factor binding site, maybe is not a CpG island. In that setting, you can't assume anything about the wild type. You need to look. And it's going to be very cell type specific. It may even be differentiation state specific. There can be a lot of functional changes that occur. And so in that scenario, if you're going to be doing a screening that compares those types of loci, you need to have a large wild type cohort so that you can get an idea of what's the population look like normal, so that you can contrast that with your experimental group to see if there's really a difference. Okay, so now I'm going to give you some examples of how we do some of these experiments. So here's an example to ask in a candidate gene approach if gene X is methylated using southern blot and a restriction, methylation-sensitive restriction enzyme. So NOT1 is a methylation-sensitive restriction enzyme. It will not cut if the DNA is methylated. And so there's a EcoR5 is not methylation-sensitive. So we have a 7KB EcoR5 fragment, and this is in the estrogen receptor promoter CpG island. So if we digest with EcoR5, and we don't add NOT1, and we do a southern blot, we find a band at 7KB. That's the expected finding. Now we want to ask, okay, if I do a double digest, EcoR5 plus NOT1, do I cut it? And if I do, I should see a 2.7KB band. And here it is. So here's a set of normal samples. And in every case where the NOT1 is added in, you can see that the band is small at the 2.7KB. Now we've got a set of tumor DNAs, and we want to know, is there methylation at this NOT1 site at any of them? So these are all double digests, and you can see this one has very high levels of methylation, but if you look carefully, you can see faint bands up here. So when NOT1's methylated, it doesn't cut, and you get the 7KB band. A scanning approach is to use methyldip, or MEDIP. This is methylated DNA immunoprecipitation. To do this approach, you take sonicated DNA, you sonicate it down to about 500 base pair fragments, denature the DNA to make it single-stranded, which makes the epitope accessible to the enzyme. You immunoprecipitate with an antibody to 5-methylcytosine, or you don't. You collect the input DNA, and then you collect the IP DNA. And the IP DNA should be enriched for methylated molecules compared to the input DNA. And then you can measure this in a number of different ways. One common way to do it is to take that DNA, label the input DNA red, label the IP DNA that's enriched for methylated DNA green, and hybridize to a microarray to ask which of these features are methylated. Red spots like this one indicate a CpG island that's not enriched in the IP and therefore not methylated. Yellow spots like these indicate a CpG island that's partially enriched by the IP, so you get equal green and yellow signal, and therefore there's partial methylation. And then green spots like this indicate a CpG island that's strongly enriched by the IP and therefore highly methylated. So if you have a microarray of all CpG islands in the genome, you can apply this type of an approach, and you can get a picture of which CpG islands are highly methylated, partially methylated, or unmethylated. More commonly used now is next-generation sequencing. So you do massively parallel sequencing of short tags of the enriched DNA compared to the background or the input DNA. So now, instead of labeling up those two pools of DNA and hybridizing, competitively hybridizing, now you're just going to sequence them. And if you're enriched for a region, you'll get lots of sequencing reads, lots of hits, lots of tags mapping to the same region. And that will show you that this locus is highly methylated. So methylation is indicated by many short sequencing tags mapping to a region in the enriched DNA. And for comparisons, your control DNA, the unenriched DNA, will show very few tags to that region. So imagine now applying this to the entire genome. You can find everywhere in the genome where there's high-level methylation. So now we're going to talk about sodium bisulfite treatment. So this chemically converts unmethylated C to T after PCR amplification. Methylated cytosines remain as cytosines. So here's an example of DNA, wild-type DNA. Here's a methyl cytosine, here's an unmethylated cytosine, and a couple other unmethylated cytosines. After bisulfite treatment, this C converts to T, this C converts to T, this C converts to T. This C has been protected. Okay, so now I can tell whether this CPG is methylated or not, each of these CPGs. So when I say that it converts to T, it converts to uracil, actually. That's what the chemical conversion is. But then we have to do PCR in order to detect that, and that PCR replaces the uracil with a T. So after this chemical conversion, creating a sequence difference between methylated DNA and unmethylated DNA, we can interrogate that sequence difference in different ways. One way is bisulfite sequencing. To do bisulfite sequencing, you design PCR primers that sit outside your region of interest to areas that don't contain any CPGs, so that after bisulfite conversion, there will be no difference in those regions where the primers bind. And your question is, the area in between, all these CGs in between, is the methylation present or absent? In other words, is the C retained or the T retained? And so, after you amplify, here's an example of after bisulfite conversion what the methylated DNA would look like. Here's what unmethylated DNA would look like. And then when you do the sequencing, you can see either a T at this position or a C at this position. Same here, same here. Here you can see a little hint of C indicating maybe there's a little bit of methylation at that position. So that's how bisulfite sequencing is used, to tell in detail exactly which CPGs are methylated or unmethylated. And a key here is that your primers sit to regions that don't contain any CPGs. So after bisulfite conversion, you know what that sequence will be for sure. So here's an example of bisulfite sequencing data in a study. Each of these rows represents a CPG position. Open circles represent unmethylated, meaning a T is what we sequenced. Closed circles represent methylated, meaning a C was sequenced in that position. Each row is an individual clone. So what you do is after bisulfite treatment, you do the PCR, you take that PCR product and you clone it, and then you transform. Well, you take that PCR product, you clone it, you do mini preps, and then you sequence. Each mini prep is basically trapping an individual molecule. And you can sequence, and you can see that on this molecule, every one of the CPGs was unmethylated. And we did this many times, and in all cases, patient number 4, looking at P16 in a head and neck cancer patient, the normal adjacent tissue showed no methylation of the P16 locus. When we went to the primary tumor, you could see many of these clones are completely methylated. Here's a clone where one CPG position is unmethylated, but it's essentially methylated. And then there's also clones that are unmethylated. So there's partial methylation, about 50% methylation, in this patient's primary tumor. And in the same patient's metastatic tumor, the lymph node metastasis, it looks more like the normal tissue. So bisulfite sequencing then gives us a sense of exactly where is the methylation and how prevalent is it. Is it 100% unmethylated, 50% methylated, or just very low-level methylated? Another approach after bisulfite treatment is to do methylation-specific PCR. Now, this is different than bisulfite sequencing because it gives you different information depending on the primer design. So here, we designed two primer sets. One is specific for the methylated sequence, will only amplify the methylated molecules. So the primers are designed here containing C's at these positions. So those primers are only going to bind if there are C's in those positions, and that will only be true if the DNA was methylated. Then you design a primer pair that's specific for the unmethylated sequence. These primers have T's at those positions, and they will only amplify if the bisulfite converted, and that'll only be true if there was no methylation in that position. This is a non-quantitative approach. You simply look for presence or absence of band using the methylated primer set, and your unmethylated primer set acts as a control for locus integrity. So is the locus there? So here's an example. Again, this is the same data that I showed previously about head and neck cancers. Here's patient number 4 where we detected methylation in the primary tumor, but now we're doing it by methyl-specific PCR. So we've got an unmethylated primer set and a methylated primer set all the way for all of these patients. And you can see for the primary tumor of patient 4, we get a band using unmethylated primers. We also get a band using methylated primers, meaning there's both methylated DNA and unmethylated DNA in there. And that matches what we saw by bisulfite sequencing. In the metastatic tumor from that same patient, we don't see any band in the methylated using the methylated primers, but we do see one using the unmethylated primers. So we know that the locus is there, it's just not methylated. If we look at patient 4 T metastasis, we don't even get a band using the unmethylated primers, suggesting that the locus has been deleted in this patient. Okay, so this brings us to a conceptual point. Which is that I mentioned before that DNA methylation of a CpG island can lead to transcriptional silencing, which is analogous to loss of function mutations. The cell doesn't really care why there's no P16. P16 could be mutated, it could be deleted, or it could just be silenced by DNA methylation. The end result is a loss of function of P16. It's all the same to the cell. So we had this interesting scenario where in patient 4, in the primary tumor, there was methylation of P16, but in the metastatic tumor, there wasn't methylation of P16. When we looked at expression, you could see very little expression of P16 in the primary tumor, but lots of expression in the metastatic tumor. Will that fit with the observation of the methylation? We saw methylation in the primary tumor, so we didn't expect expression. And in fact, there is barely any. This is probably contaminating normal tissue that this is coming from. But in the metastatic tumor, where there was no hypermethylation, we had no reason to expect there to be a lack of transcription, and in fact, there's plenty of transcription. However, when we take this and sequence it, and we take this and sequence it, we find that it's wild type up here in the primary tumor, and it's probably coming from the contaminating normal tissue. You can see the very low level of expression. But in the metastatic tumor, where there's no DNA methylation and there's tons of expression, there's a deletion. It's a 17 base pair deletion, creates a nonsense mutation after amino acid 60 early in exon 2. So in other words, it's a loss of function mutation. And so from this same patient, we've got the primary tumor and the metastatic tumor, and they use two different ways to get P16 loss of function, emphasizing the point that the loss of function is important, one, and two, cell doesn't really care how it accomplishes that. Right, so patient 4 head and neck primary tumor has CpG island methylation, both methyl-specific PCR and bisulfite sequencing demonstrate that methylation, and there's a lack of transcription due to this, and that leads to loss of function of P16. The lymph node metastasis from the same patient does not have methylation. Both methyl-specific PCR and bisulfite sequencing demonstrate that lack of methylation. Accordingly, we find that there's plenty of transcription. However, that transcript has a deletion in exon 2, causing non-functional truncation, again, leading to loss of function of P16. So how can the primary and the metastatic tumors from the same patient have different mechanisms for loss of P16 function? I mean, we think of metastatic tumors deriving from the primary tumor, clonally evolving out of the primary tumor. Well, we can have dynamic CpG island hypermethylation. So could the methylation of CpG islands be erased to give the cells an advantage when metastasizing? This idea would be unique to epigenetic changes, and it could be regulated through active demethylation of a specific promoter. So unlike a genetic change, an epigenetic change is reversible. All right, once you delete something, you're not going to get it back. But if you silence something by CpG ion hypermethylation, it's at least conceivable that you could remove that methylation. So you could have this plasticity. So there's an example of this in the literature. The E-cadherin gene. The E-cadherin protein is involved in cell-cell adhesion. So it's very useful to cells that are growing in a tumor mass. However, it's detrimental to invasiveness. It's detrimental to cells breaking away from metastasis. However, again, it's useful for establishment of the tumor at the metastatic site because, again, the cells want to grow in a clump. So there's a prostate cancer cell line that, when grown in a monolayer, has heterogeneous hypermethylation of E-cadherin. In other words, if you do bisulfite sequencing, you find that there's plenty of alleles that are completely methylated, and there's some alleles that are unmethylated. If you take that cell line and you put it in a model system of basement membrane invasion, so a Boyden chamber with a chemoattractant on the bottom, and you want to measure, can you get the cells to invade through the membrane or through the matrigel, what we find is increased hypermethylation of E-cadherin. If you then look at those cells that invaded, meaning silencing of E-cadherin. Remember, E-cadherin helps cells stick together. Cells that want to invade and migrate don't want to have a lot of E-cadherin. If you take that same cell line and you put it in a model system of three-dimensional tumor growth, so soft agar, now cells are growing in clumps. They need to stick together in order to grow well. They found reduced methylation of E-cadherin. So you can imagine then a carcinoma in situ growing into a primary tumor, progressing into a primary tumor. Increased methylation, silencing of E-cadherin allows for invasion, but at the point of primary tumor growth, you could reduce methylation to allow for expression, to allow for tumor establishment. But then again, if the cells are going to invade into the lymphatics and get into the bloodstream in order to metastasize, they need to be migratory again. And in that scenario, you might expect increased methylation of the E-cadherin gene, silencing that gene, allowing them to separate from each other and migrate. But again, at the metastatic site, in order to colonize and grow, they need to stick together again. So this idea of epigenetic plasticity is something that's important that is actively being studied that can allow for cancer cells to adapt to changing environments, changing scenarios, where genes, in certain situations, they want a gene on, but in other situations, they're going to want that same gene off. Epigenetics affords the ability of the cell to adjust in a way that genetic changes don't. Another idea, which is probably a simpler idea, even though it's an ugly figure, is this idea of clonal evolution of subpopulations of cells. So with the black dots indicating methylation events throughout the genome, as we progress to a small primary tumor, we replicate, we have clonal expansion of these cells with the same methylation pattern. But as the cells continue to grow, either due to random chance or simply microenvironment-specific selective pressures, subcolonies grow with new methylation events. And maybe they lose some of the old methylation events. This progresses to a larger tumor, finally leading to a large primary tumor, where here's the initial core methylation pattern of cells, but then some cells have gained quite a bit of methylation, other cells have lost methylation, and it's this subpopulation of cells that have changes their advantageous to metastatic spread. And you might imagine a situation where most of the cells here have methylation of, let's say, the P16 gene, but this group of cells don't have methylation of the P16 gene. They've got mutation of that gene. That is the one that contributes to the lymph node metastasis. So this idea of subpopulation having different methylation patterns and mutation patterns And then that could lead to differences between the primary tumor and the metastasis. Okay, so to summarize this last part then, global hypomethylation of bulk chromatin occurs, so all the repetitive elements, many of the repetitive elements become hypomethylated. And in cancer, we see localized hypermethylation of CpG islands. This silences tumor suppressor genes if the CpG island is in the promoter. Forget about this, I didn't talk about this, but we can detect methylation using methylation-sensitive enzymes, for instance, by a southern blot, which is a candidate gene approach. We can also detect methylation using bisulfite treatment through bisulfite sequencing or methylation-sensitive PCR. Scanning approaches give us limited information about many loci, whereas candidate gene approaches give us detailed information about a few loci. And then conceptually, a cancer cell doesn't really care why there's loss of function of a tumor suppressor gene. Genetic or epigenetic reasons give the same result. However, epigenetic changes can be reversed. Cancer cells may take advantage of this for certain genes. This is more hypothetical than proven fact at this point, although there are specific examples that have been shown where this occurs. And the other concept here is that tumors are heterogeneous. Different subpopulations may use different routes of loss of function. And that's all I have. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you.